RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Feisty Friday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with...
Absolutely gorgeous Friday. Gorgeous end of the month Friday in August in New York. Beautiful, cool, sweet-smelling air, Val.
Did you write all that down?
Nope.
You're going to have to repeat that at the end of the show.
We're going to see. We'll see what happens.
It's Tracy Beams. And obviously, there are a bunch of topics on the forefront of everybody's mind. I started, Frank, listening to your interview with Dave yesterday, and I couldn't finish it because I kept getting phone calls. I was a little bit, I was like, wow, Frank didn't even ask me to come on and talk about this. I'm amazed.
I forgot about me. Well, you know, it is, Tracy, I wasn't even going to take a call, but I wasn't going to take a call on it. I just wanted to throw it on out there because the IG excerpt report breakaway, whatever the hell it is, the side dish that we got yesterday on James Comey, something we've been waiting for a while. We knew that there was going to be no prosecutorial action coming from it, and we already had a good understanding of why that would be the case. And as far as Dave goes, Dave, I just realized, was back on Twitter after a long, long hiatus, and I was so excited that he was there. We had been talking in DMs, getting caught up, and I said, you know what? He said, well, when you want to do a show, I'd love to come back on. I gave him 5 minutes, and it turned into 8. So that was that.
Yeah, he's great. I you know, there's been a falling out, obviously, between the last refuge conservative treehouse and myself, but I love Dave, and I loved his work back then, and I think I'm going to love it again now. So I'm really glad he's back. I'm really, really glad he's back. I was like,
you want to start with Comey?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a necessity for sure. I went a little crazy yesterday. I got to be honest. I'm going to cut it. Nobody needs to hear this over again. If you listen to my scope yesterday, you heard the first 20 minutes was me venting like a human being. Some people got upset about it. A lot of people didn't. But I basically wanted to, like, I don't know about you, Frank, but do you read all your stuff, all your comments, as many as you can and everything that come in, right?
Yeah, for the most part.
I make it like a personal mission to do that. It's crazy, but it is. It's a personal thing of mine that I'm going to read every email and I'm going to read almost every comment that I can possibly cram into my brain to see what everybody has to say.
Emails, comments, I can't. I used to be able to do comments a lot more, but that could ruin your day real quick.
Well, hence. But I did my thread on Comey yesterday. As I read the report, I did the thread on it, and I was reading all the comments that were being put underneath my tweets, and all of them were so, like, distraught and negative, and a lot of people were saying they were done, and they were walking away, and they were done with everything. And I started saying to myself, you know, There's a fact set here that people are just absolutely ignoring, because there are other folks out there on Twitter stoking this emotional hysteria with misinformation. For example, saying Horowitz let him skate. What does that mean?
I don't know.
Horowitz let him skate.
Horowitz is an inspector, not a prosecutor.
Thank you.
He told you exactly what's going on there. Somebody outside of Horowitz needs to assess whether or not this is something worthy of pursuit.
So, like, and you're absolutely right. So when somebody says Horowitz let him skate again, the people automatically say everything Horowitz does is discredited now. That's the first thing they think. We can't trust Horowitz. That's what people say. When in actuality, Horowitz served up a dish of whoop-ass on Comey, the likes of which I haven't seen in a very long time, and also referred him for prosecution. He made the recommendation to the Department of Justice that he broke criminal statute. The Department of Justice, under Barr, decided not to charge him. And Undercover Huber, and even Jeff from the Epoch Times, and even Dave, and myself, and a lot of other people have done a really... have tried really hard to explain to people why it is that Comey wasn't charged for this. And it just, it is what it is. It doesn't mean that he is skating because he's above the law. It means that they're following the law. Does that make sense?
Yeah. There's going to be a lot of difference of opinion here, just because people are out of their minds with frustration right now. I understand. It's been like a BDSM orgasm denial. You know, it's been like orgasm denial for 3 years. I understand. Everybody's got blue balls right now.
You know that I'm not going to go there. There's like some Airbnb that's renting out a BDSM room for $950 a night.
Oh no.
Yeah, is that horrible? Anyway, I just saw that come across my plate before you got on the phone here. I got on whatever. It's just funny that you said that. Anyway, so like, where was I? Oh, so I understand why everybody's frustrated. Absolutely, because I get it. At the same time, like, it does nobody any good to say, well, yeah, but. Now, what do we want to do here? Do we want to look at a fact set and come to a conclusion? Or do we want to act in a hysterical fashion out of emotion just because we're so frustrated with the slow progress or the slow trek upward? And I understand everybody needs to vent and everybody needs to get the stuff off their chest. And Twitter is a good place to do it and just tweet out your thoughts, and then the rest of the crowd can come along and agree with you, and it makes you feel like you're a part of something and it makes you feel like you aren't alone. And I understand all the mechanics behind that. But I need, I just need to say this. I'm a human being and a human being, as I always make a joke. And I see all of it and I internalize all of it, and I reacted too. And some people got upset that I did that because they say that they come to like look for information and not for an emotional response. And I'm like, well, when you're bombarded with thousands of messages emotionally responding and that's all you see, you know, some people see 10 tweets. I see thousands of them. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I understand.
It's not a woe is me or anything like that. I'm just trying to explain why I did say what I said. I said if basically, like, if you're going to just, you know, give up hope and not care anymore, then move the hell out of the way for the people that will, because that's how we got here in the first place. And you giving up and not caring is not going to help us to move past this and fix it. And a lot of people are like, well, what are we supposed to do?
My answer is going to be like a broken record. What are we supposed to do? Your responsibility is to wherever the hell you live.
Yeah.
Your responsibility is to your family. Your responsibility is to creating and educating a new generation so that we have better. Nothing was going to be the generations that cause the problems are still largely in power. How the hell are we going to turn that around in a couple of years? We need to be able to plant new seeds and rotate the crops a little bit more. So, I mean, the fact that we've got this much disclosure as it is, and we've got this much validation as it is, even if we haven't been able to collect the scalps that we wanted to collect,
But that's the thing. That's the thing, too, is that there isn't a scalp to collect on this. There's no case.
Oh, I understand. With this particular thing, I understand. And that's why I seriously have not really been that upset about it, only because knowing what is still on the... I always assess what the possible moves are available on the chessboard still are. And for all the outcomes and all of the things that have yet to arrive, I don't know why anybody is defeatist. And even let's say all of the doors have been shut. What are you going to do in 2020? Seriously, I mean, this is so simple to me. What needs to still be done? And the only thing that we're looking for here, we are the solution and we are the problem.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You know, so I've seen a lot of, I hang out on GLP. It's a conspiracy site. I hang out on godlikeproductions.com a lot. It's a message board, and it's, there's a lot of interesting threads. There's a lot of shit threads there too. But either way, there's so many people now who are saying I voted for Trump in 2016, and they're telling you why they will or will not vote for him in 2020.
Like,
and
Go ahead.
No. And it really just comes down to one thing, and because it ties into everything else. There is nothing complex about this. Nobody at this point is going to be able to align completely and give everybody what they want. The only thing you should be thinking about is the Supreme Court. That is it, because it buys us time. And time will give us some kind of a buffer to maybe create a new paradigm in which this the frustrations that we're going through right now are allayed a little bit better. That's all I can say.
It's great. That's great. Yes. Because that was why a lot of people voted for him in the first place. And we've got Ginsburg, you know, basically knocking on the door here, getting ready to go. And it's important. But like somebody said, like, nothing's ever going to change. Nothing's happening. And I get that that's the overwhelming sentiment. But like at the same time, I step back and I say, well, take a minute and step back. I'm not saying I have a crystal ball in front of me that I'm looking into and I can foresee the future and all of these indictments coming down the pike and everyone's going to jail. No, I'm not. God forbid we end up with nothing. There's going to be a plan of action after that. But I'm not there yet because we don't know. However, look at all of the people that are no longer in these institutions. Name them all. Do you think that would have happened if the election in 2016 hadn't have gone that way? We Comey, Strzok, McCabe, Rybicki, Priestep. Who else? Oh, gosh, there's so many. Yates. Rice, who else is there? Baker.
Everything. The thing here is this, first of all, I don't believe it is the overwhelming sentiment. We always have to keep in mind that people who listen to shows like this and are interested in topics that shows like this discuss, and there's plenty of shows like this out there, that we're a sliver of the population. And within that sliver, there are those who are optimistic and realistic and see what's out there and are willing to take their lumps to go along, and they keep the big picture in focus and the greatest goals in mind. And then there are people who get very discouraged, and rightfully so. And then there are those who are very optimistic who have their frustrated days. That is outside of a great number of people
who just don't, yeah.
Who largely don't care.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
I mean, so we are in our own bubble as well. You have to understand that.
Yeah, like if I go across the street and start talking to one of my friends about, like, or neighbors about it, and like
their eyes will glass over.
You know, it's funny though. I don't know. I think on the side of the fence where people voted in 2016, that's not necessarily true. Although they're not obviously going to be in the minutia of the Comey report about his memos like we are, they still care that people are held accountable for their nonsense. They know something went wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't mean to address this all over again. It's just that I have feelings too. And I felt bad because like some people got upset, and I'm not trying to scold you or talk down to anybody or anything. I care about this stuff as much as everybody else does. And I just had to say it. Like a mom would like tell her kids after they fail or something. Stop it. Shake yourself off. Get up and go back in there. You know?
Like Bambi's father.
Right.
Get up, Bambi.
Get up.
You must get up.
Yeah. Because why? Because I care about these. I care about this. And we need you. We need you out there. Damn it. Where's the patriotic music?
Just stay the course. That's all.
Yeah. So I want to get into a couple things, Frank.
Go ahead.
Three things out of the Comey report yesterday that nobody is talking about. Thing number one is, hold on. Who was the leaker that provided the complete set of memos to the Office of Inspector General? Did you catch this in the report?
No, actually, I haven't even read it because I saw the excerpts. I saw everybody else's breakdowns, but it's just one of those things where we knew what was coming and what was not going to come of it. So I was just going to wait for everybody else's highlights,
well,
to be
perfect.
Honest.
Perfect. So let's go over it together then, shall we?
Go ahead.
So Comey makes copies of these memos. He writes his memo, whether it be on his personal laptop, on his work laptop, on his work computer, whatever he does. And each time he does it, he takes a very specific set of actions. Very, very, very specific set of actions. He takes a copy. He gives it to Rybicki. He instructs Rybicki to show McCabe and Baker, I believe, and then have Rybicki keep a copy for himself, and then Comey will keep a copy for himself and either put it in his desk drawer at work or put it in his personal safe at home or keep wherever he decides that he's going to keep his copy. And there's a certain section of the report where Lisa Page gets roped into this somehow. And McCabe, I'm not being specific, but she gets her hands on some of these memos and makes a set of copies for herself. Undirected, and nobody asked her to do it. She just says to the IG, well, I thought these were the types of things that should have an extra copy. And she keeps them in the safe inside of her own office.
Mm.
Then she shares them with Priestep. And nobody really knows how Priestep gets read into these memos. They assume it was because of McCabe. But McCabe says, no, it wasn't me. So we have to then think it was Page because she's the only other person that had a copy of them. And then the IG says in the report, somebody came forward to us under whistleblower status. Hold on, I'll read it to you exactly. Shortly after Comey's removal, a set of the seven memos was provided to the IG by a department employee who claimed whistleblower status. This individual viewed the memos as extremely sensitive documents and was concerned that there should be a separate set deposited somewhere for safekeeping. The OIG handled and stored all seven memos consistent with the requirements for classified information, even though only memo one had any classification markings at that time, which means that it was before the FBI went back around and reclassified this stuff in July or June of 2017.
Hmm.
So I'm really nearly certain it was one of two people, Priestep or Page, that brought these to the IG after Comey was fired.
So this alone would makes me think that this that the mixed reporting on whether or not Lisa Page was going to be providing either friendly assistance to Andrew McCabe or the death blow Andrew McCabe.
She did provide the death blow. I can tell you that right now.
So if you had not suggested that right now or told me that right now, this alone would tell me, well, it looks like Paige is not doing anybody any favors at this point, because there's been quite a bit of coverage suggesting that Lisa Page was going to provide some kind of cover fire for Andy McCabe.
You know, Finch and I and a couple, you're in there with us now in the room that we've got, and you don't ever pop in there, but we were talking about how Lisa Page, the timeline of this and when this is all happening, and I haven't gotten to go back and drill down into it yet, but Finch was basically saying this is at the same time, right around the same time that Lisa Page is outing Andy McCabe to the IG about the leak to the Wall Street Journal, because Andy McCabe was basically trying to pin that on Page. Excuse me. So there's a lot of shifty stuff going on here, where people are talking to other people and or they're answering questions as though they don't know what the other people are actually answering, or they're doing things outside of what they're tasked to do to cover their own butts. You know, like we said, it's all about leverage. And once the leverage is removed, these people sing like birds and they don't give a crap who they take down on their way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that one. And there's a lot more to get into there that I will be working on over the weekend. Point number two that nobody is talking about. Who moved the memo from Comey's desk after he was fired and the office was supposed to be locked down? So when James Comey got fired, they were instructed to lock his office. Nobody's supposed to come in or out. And they had like a supervisory special agent that was supposed to catalog and inventory every item in the office and then place it in the right bucket. Like, here's FBI stuff, here's personal stuff, let's deliver it back to him, stuff like that. During the IG report, Michael Horowitz makes it a point to tell us what Jim Comey does with each of these memos. And he specifically states that he puts, I think it's at least one, in his desk drawer in his FBI office, which is a SCIF in and of itself. And it's certified for open classified. So you don't have to hide classified information in some compartment inside of the office. Mm. Because the whole office is set for it.
He just wanted to take extra precaution. He just wanted to protect information so badly. That's just what it was. He just loves his job. So, and he loves his country.
Yeah, of course he does. Yep. So he puts the...
Why don't you see this?
How much he loves his country?
Yes. You know, Tracy, and speaking back to all that frustration people have, I know the one thing that gets me there, too, is that you just have to, you know, this day was coming with the, you know, don't, nobody's going to do anything with this particular portion of the disclosures that are coming from the Inspector General's office. But it was pretty much that yesterday, everybody was declaring victory.
Yeah,
you know, that's a frustrating thing. When you have James Comey out there asking for apologies, saying that he was defamed. But then when you look at the IG report and you see what was pointed out and, it, you know, like, you know, the highlights or whatever, what was actually pointed out, what he had done. It's just like everybody has reason to celebrate because, you know, anybody who if you're not charged with a crime, what are you going to do? So everybody was celebrating. Everybody's declaring victory. So. That's what I'm just thinking about. Well, everything you're going through right now, still, yesterday's turn of events allowed James Comey to demand apologies on Twitter.
It didn't allow him to. He was going to do it anyway.
Well.
It didn't allow him to.
Unless he was whisked off and charged.
Well, I get it. Yeah. But anyway, so basically, my mom scolds me for saying that word too much. I'm trying to stop it to have it. What happens is... Do you notice that I say that all the time?
I picked certain things up, but yeah. It's not. I mean, you brought it up before on the show, and you said that your mother had told you about it. So since that first time you brought up the Basically show,
Mama Beans. Said, I know you're listening right now, Mama Beans. Thank you, but no thank you.
Always listen to Mother.
I know. So what happens is where was I? Okay. So. The OIG tells us specifically that Comey does certain things with these memos and puts them in his desk drawer, et cetera, so on and so forth. And then Comey gets fired. They're supposed to lock the office. Horowitz talks to the supervisory special agent who is working outside, you know, working to catalog stuff in the office. And he asks the supervisory special agent what he found in there. And they show them everything. And they say, wait a second, there's no memo here. They never cataloged a memo coming out of his drawer in his desk. Comey gets fired. A couple days goes by. Apparently, he gets on the phone with Rybicki. And all of a sudden, Rybicki takes this memo out of the chief of staff's office outside of Comey's office and says, here you go. And the SSA is like, what is this? And he's like, oh, it's a memo. You know, I didn't know that you wanted these. I thought you were just looking for what was inside of the office. First of all, who took it out and when? Did it come out when he got fired? Did it come out before he got fired, which would mean he had some idea he was going to get fired? Did they intend on hiding this crap and then realize they had no other direction they could go in but to let it out? Mm. Did, you know what I'm saying? These are the questions that are... And then after speaking to Comey, he decides that he's going to go retrieve this thing, which means he knew exactly where it was. Mm. I want to know more.
Yeah. And you think we're going to find out more? Like, is this a prologue for what is going to still come out? Or you know, is this pretty much, since this is not going to result, I would have to imagine that the easiest way for us to learn more about this is if somebody thought that this was actually a situation that could be prosecuted.
If they thought this was a situation that could be prosecuted, I don't know that we'd have this report right now.
Got it. Okay. That's something to consider.
But that's also not necessarily true because we got the McCabe report and there's criminal charges pending or hopefully pending for him. Hmm. So I don't know. Like Joe DeGeneva said, if you get the FISA report, they're not indicting anyone.
If we get the report?
Yeah, like if they release the report, then that means they're not criminally indicting anyone.
Oh.
And I say balderdash because they released the McCabe report. And yes, granted, it's taken them a year, but they're going to criminally indict him from everything I can gather. And what happens then? What happens when they criminally indict McCabe? Is everyone going to be like, oh, big deal?
It's either going to be big deal because they do not care about these people. Ultimately, it's all of their heroes are disposable. They will throw the Clintons under the bus at this point now, too, because she and her husband are not viable candidates for anything. And it costs them nothing to have integrity on the issue. Now they can throw them down. They can throw them out if they want. Mm-hmm. Andrew McCabe. Most Americans only know this guy's name now because of this whole thing. Otherwise, he was just another pimple on the ass of the government. So, you know, nobody cares. So it'll either be big deal, or it'll either be look at Donald Trump's administration, vengeful as ever, going after people to hide a scandal-riddled administration. You know, it's one or two things. You're never, ever going to get the Scooby-Doo moment.
There's one more thing that no one's talking about. They're talking about the entrapment of the president. They're talking about all that stuff. But the last thing that nobody is talking about is this. And I did some work into this today. When did Comey talk to Mueller about the memos he had in his personal safe in his home? All throughout the entire report, he talks about how, Horowitz talks about how, Comey put these memos in a personal safe, and literally, as per them, nobody on God's green earth knows but Comey that they're in there. The FBI comes to his house to retrieve whatever. He doesn't tell them they're there. The people that are interviewed at the FBI say, oh my God, that's so horrible. How could he do something like that? That's stunning and horrible. That's where all those words came from. Stunning, disappointing, you know, all those words that everybody at the FBI used to describe what James Comey had done. When he finally hands them over, it's after he testifies in front of the committee. As a matter of fact, he requests to be able to read a copy of the memos to familiarize himself with them again before he testifies. And the FBI is forced to come to his house with them because he doesn't say that he has a copy on his own. So that's how far he's going to cover up the fact that he's got these memos in his personal safe. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then something happens. They come to, he hands them over eventually. And they ask him, why didn't you tell us about these sooner? And he says, well, Robert Mueller wants them. And I'm like, wait, what? Robert Mueller wants them? I said, that's crazy. How did Robert Mueller know they even existed? Robert Mueller asked for the personal memos Comey had in his safe. Comey says, Comey told the OIG that he voluntarily gave his signed originals of memos 2, 4, 6, and 7 to the SSA at his house that day, not because he has concerns that they contain classified information, but, quote, because special counsel Robert Mueller asked for them.
And this was already after Mueller had been appointed special counsel?
Yes. Now, a couple things are going to stem from this. The first one being, the only 302 that I can find referenced in the Mueller report that indicates that he had an interview with James Comey was on 11/15/17, way after all this. Nobody else knew about these, even in the FBI, and he supposedly, and I'm saying supposedly because I don't know if these people are telling the truth that they didn't know about them now, because Robert Mueller apparently did and personally asked James Comey for them. How did Robert Mueller know?
We know certain things about James Comey's intent, especially with the memos. So if the memos were the express intent of getting the memos out or in some kind of a limited way, first of all, you're seeing all the layers of the onion. And when I say layers, I mean layers of protection, how James Comey was trying to insulate himself with different layers of protection here. Number one, he was hiding things. As we can see, he's squirreling away acorns like a little chipmunk. And the other thing he's doing is he has also been very, very thoughtful in the legal protections he can give himself by giving out releasing only certain types of information, excluding others and whatnot, and creating the kind of situation that we have right now that would actually lead Bill Barr to choose to not go after a leaky case in this memo scandal. So all these different layers of protection and deflection and things that are going to help his odds of getting out of this unscathed while still inflicting maximum political damage to the president is all becoming very, very clear. Now, and going back to the intent thing, his intent with all of this was to launch a special counsel. And of course, he had to have known that Robert Mueller was on the short list. So it's just Occam's razor to me. How does Robert Mueller know? There's probably so much more coordination behind the scenes to make all of this happen and develop exactly the way that they wanted to, while providing maximum legal protection and alibis in court if it should ever see an American court one day.
Yeah.
And it's just the most obvious thing. Mueller was always going to be that special counsel. They just had to figure out how to get to that point.
Well, it's funny because it's not funny, but like it, you know, reading the huge section in the Mueller report again about these memos just makes you laugh, because, you know, just looking at the one action that was taken here that gives the whole thing away. They speak to Donald Trump about the salacious rumor about what he did in Russia. And then they immediately enter that memo into the system to catalog it. But the rest of his memos, they don't. And so, like, It just gives them away, like what their purpose. You know what I mean? They were trying to entrap him, and it's just gross. But anyway, those are the three things that I just wanted to point out that I think that are really important that nobody, I don't see many people talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we're going to leave this for now, because there'll be more coming, of course. And, you know, we'll talk about that. But there are other things happening. There was a tweet that just came out today. From Technofog, Flynn update, joint status report has been filed. Alleged that the U.S. in violation of Sullivan's order has, quote, failed to produce the original or first draft of the FBI 302 of the interview of Mr. Flynn. And the government has failed to produce, quote, records or documents that show everyone who made the changes to the 302. And the U.S. continues to deny Flynn's counsel request for security clearance. Without clearance, they can't know the details of how Flynn debriefed the DIA about his foreign contacts and travel. Could this be the other information Sidney Powell referenced in the last hearing? And the U.S. responds to this, the government. They propose a late October, early November sentencing hearing. They have no other documents relating to the 302, and they're not aware of any classified info that requires disclosures under Brady. I think that there is a pissing match going on here for sure. It's interesting because basically the 302 that was in existence is not the original. Where's the original? That's what they're saying. The original 302. Remember how there was one that was dated in July of that year or June of that year that had been changed?
I think so. The 302 subject has always been a little bit confusing to me for that very same reason, that there was 302s suppressed, changed, produced, and produced very, very late on, especially given how, you know, and when I say later on in the game, I mean with those initial interviews with the FBI being in January 2017 and then being produced so many months afterwards.
They basically made 302s about the 302s.
Right.
But anyway, there's some discrepancy there. And then, you know, why shouldn't Sidney Powell have clearance to be able to look at this stuff? You don't need it because there's nothing there. And even the judge was pushing back against that. Let's see what the judge says. We shall see. Another thing that came up today. There is a person that stepped down as basically a staffer who was like a gatekeeper for the president in the Oval Office. She was a never Trumper who was appointed there by the RNC. And this is like not, you know, something that people don't know at this point, so I'll just share. There was a deal with the RNC and the Trump campaign that they had to staff certain people in certain positions. And that's why you had a lot of swamp rats dwindling, you know, running around there for a certain amount of time. Because to be quite honest, when the deal was struck, nobody knew any better. They just didn't know any better. So long story short, this was one of those people. Her name is Westerhout. She's a young girl who sat out there and apparently was sitting with the New York Times in D.C. or in Jersey near the president's club while he was there on a working sort of a trip, and sat with the New York Times, supposedly off the record, and dished all kinds of stuff about the Trump administration. She was a leaker.
Mm.
She stepped down yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that.
But the reporter burned her as a source. Completely burned her. In other words, he used her name and used the conversation that they had when it was supposedly off the record to call her out, which is like the most horrific offense that a journalist can commit. And it's happened a lot lately. It happened to Ed Butowski. It happens a lot. David Korn did it. People just, they've abandoned any journalistic integrity whatsoever. Like if I have a conversation with somebody and they say, listen, this is completely off the record. You're not allowed to say this. Not only do I not say it, because there's this like almost like privilege that's there between a reporter and a source, just like an attorney and a client or a priest and a parishioner who's confessing. It sounds like over the top, but it's true. There's a confidence there that you're just not supposed to ever break. So if a source comes to you with something and says, this is off the record, you can't say anything, and you say, okay. And then the next day you go out and you write an article, not only just saying what you were supposed to not say, but using the name of the person who told you. It's basically a career killer. No source will ever go and talk to you after that about anything.
Yeah. Well, people don't care about careers that much. They don't care about integrity that much. You can see it. Certain, at least the people at the upper echelons of good work, but yeah. there's a lot of lower rung folks who do writing, and they're out there to achieve a mission, and they'll do anything to break a story, even if they have to break some rules.
Yeah, well, that's a cardinal rule. And Brian did a thread about it. He says, in all the years I followed the media, the only times I ever saw a reporter burn a source that spoke off the record was when it was done as payback for the source giving them bad information. So far, I can't see any real reason for the reporters Westerhout spoke to doing this. Mm. If as a reporter, you tell a source your conversation's off the record and then you later publicly out the source, that means you can't be trusted. So whoever this reporter is that burned her, you can bet she's going to name them, and then nobody in D.C. is ever going to speak to them again. Remember what I wrote a long time ago. You don't immediately remove every leaker. This is absolutely true. If you're smart, you leave some in place to feed them disinformation to give to your enemies. So it could be she was being used as a source all this time and Trump knew and the Washington Post burned her. In other words, Trump knew that she was doing what she was doing and was feeding her bad information to give to them so that they would look like idiots. Get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
After she was used to feed them disinformation that blew up in their faces one time too many, they outed her. But there are multiple possibilities. Unknown enemy spy betrayed her own side after simply handing over too much stuff that turned out to be wrong. So in other words, she didn't know that she was being used to catch a leaker. You know what I mean? She didn't know she was being used as a leaker. She thought she was getting good intel.
Right.
She went to whatever journalist and told them the intel. And after one too many times of it, them printing and it being wrong, they just said, F this girl, we're going to out her. But she didn't personally know that she was getting bad intel. Right.
You know, whatever happened, I know that this might be slightly off topic, but whatever happened, what was the conclusion again of that article about, you know, I am a resistor inside of the White House? You remember that? There wasn't.
No, they never said who it was.
So it was just a fake?
No, fake out? No. That person wrote that and then we never knew who it was. They said it was Pence, remember, because of something he said or a phrase, and they were trying to figure out who it was using like the cadence of the words, but they never were able to figure out who it was and the person never came forward.
Okay.
But I get where you're going with that. It's really not off topic, to be honest.
Yeah, snakes everywhere.
Yeah.
Snakes everywhere. And that's why, you know, when I bring up a lot of people are talking about Tulsi Gabbard and what's going on with her and the DNC as if that's anything new. But I like to remind people that the RNC did not want Trump and fought tooth and nail to avoid him till it was unavoidable.
Yep.
You know, so both of these parties are awful.
Yep.
And nobody, it's
you're
hardest
right.
Thing.
They are both awful. They're horrible.
Awful.
You know, at least it's funny too, before we go on to the next thing, because both of the parties have gone through a dramatic transformation in terms of the people, but not the machinations behind the scenes that are pulling the strings or attempting to. So the DNC, the machinations behind the scenes had to adjust a little bit to what happened. And they did so with this whole debate thing that is still nonsense. But at least they made the appearance of trying to shift the way they did things. Mm-hmm. And the party fundamentally changed in and of itself in a gazillion different ways. But especially in the fact that now it's no longer Democrat, meaning, you know, JFK Democrat, or haven't been there for a long time anyway, but now it's like completely extreme left for the most part. And the Democrats that are left over that thought they were like the middle of the road Democrats have nowhere to go in their own party anymore. They're like, I'm not a Democrat. I don't know where to go. Hence walk away. Right.
Yep.
The Republican side fundamentally changed on a grassroots level because it was like an overzealous Tea Party movement that came back in, but hasn't really been co-opted yet.
It hasn't gone far enough.
No, it hasn't. But you have to admit that the Republican Party of 2014 is not the same Republican Party of today.
Oh, no. And that's also mainly because Donald Trump was a strong enough figure to drag the entire party.
Yeah.
He dragged the entire party. And that forced a lot of people to resign. So there is a flushing out that's going on. Anybody else would have been kowtowing to what the party wants and bringing the party's people. And I know that Trump has had to make certain concessions, as we can see.
Yeah, but what he was able to do in the interim. And the machinations of the Republican Party have changed, not at a local level as much as on a national level. On the local level, you still got your good old boys clubs, the never Trumpers, the little swamp creatures, the people that run the local stuff, which is why what you say all the time is so important, to get involved locally and change your local committees and all that stuff is so important. But on a national level, like Ronna McDaniel is sending out like ridiculous trolling pro-Trump tweets. You would never, in God's, never have seen that. They used to call us ragamuffins. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
I was a Ron Paul girl, obviously, and they were trying to like get me to be more Republican so that I would be able to like, they were trying to like culture shock change the way that some of the people that were libertarians rooting for Ron Paul to win the primaries acted, partially because he actually did have a chance and partially because they were trying to set Rand up to run for the Republican nomination. And wanted to take the support that Ron Paul had and migrate it over to Rand Paul. So long story short, these were a bunch of people, ragtag misfits, basically. They weren't clean kempt. They didn't wear suits and ties. They didn't, you know, they didn't conduct themselves the way the Republican Party requested they. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they started calling us ragamuffins.
Well, to hell with them.
Yeah. So we were the ragamuffins. We embraced it. Like they were our, that was our deplorable label, ragamuffins. Anyway, that's that. So that's almost the same thing. Like, so the ragamuffins have now kind of changed the Republican Party to the point where they know there's 94, if not more, support for Donald Trump within the Republican Party. And so they know that the Republican Party is fundamentally different and is kind of like taking the place of where the Democrat Party used to be like years and years and years ago for the middle class. Like, it's crazy the way things have shifted. What a tangent we got off on. I'm sorry.
No, hey, it's one thing or the other. It's one thing or the other. And especially when it comes down to that, I'm happy that there's a little, I was talking to somebody about it, and I have a couple of clients, personal training clients I was talking to about this too. And one of my clients, Sue, she's a very, very, very classy 80-year-old lady.
Oh my God.
I've been training her since she was 71. All right. I remember actually, I think it was probably about maybe about 5 years ago or so. She did a 7-minute plank.
Damn.
She would not go down. Seven minutes.
I can't even
15
do a
seconds.
Plank for 15 seconds.
She still does 3.5-minute planks.
My God,
at 80, yeah. So she's She's nasty. This is good stuff. But we were talking the other day, and she goes, you know, I really can't stomach Trump, but I hope he wins again. And, you know, so that's just really what it comes down to here, is that I'm looking at all of this and I'm saying to myself, between those conversations I have and everything else, there is only one direction in which people are walking.
Yeah.
And it's away from the left into the direction of the right. And when I say left to right, I'm talking about tyranny into liberty.
Yeah.
And even if the disparity between the two parties is nominal at this point, and they're both largely left-wing, left-leaning parties in the grand constitutional scheme of things, we are so far and so late in the game that we just need a nudge. We just need something to start the momentum elsewhere. And that's it. That's why, ultimately, when I look at these ridiculous polls that came out, the Quinnipiac poll that came out yesterday, that said that every major Democrat candidate right now is beating Trump by nine points.
Right. Sure. Even Beto, right? Even Beto.
Everybody.
Oh,
everybody.
Give me a break.
That Pete buddy guy, he is beating Trump at like a 49-40.
I beg to differ. That's just...
Oh man, the only thing I hope, and I know that it will not be lost on anybody, because anybody that was paying attention to the midterms, where Fox News was telling everybody to stay home at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Yes.
It's all over. Stay home. The House has been lost 9 p.m. Eastern time, when there's still 3 to 4 hours left in Hawaii and Alaska and the West Coast to go out there and vote. We need to keep that in mind, because it is a full-throated effort to either keep one side or the other dejected and give up, or overconfident and stay home to watch the fireworks. You need to go out. Ignore everything. We need tunnel vision.
Yeah.
Tunnel vision. That's it.
Agreed. Tunnel vision is right, because that's the only way. Don't give a crap what anybody else tells you. Go out and cast your vote.
That's it.
Let's get back to this, so we'll just finish this off.
Okay.
If we remember where we were. So there's the leaker. There are a couple different possibilities. Sorry for that huge segue, guys. There was the unknown enemy spy betrayed by her own side after simply handing over too much stuff that turned out to be wrong. Meaning, she's fed information. She's a leaker. She doesn't realize she's being used to figure out that she's a leaker. She leaks the stuff to the press. The press gets wind that none of her stuff is true, and they decide to out her as a source anyway. Right?
Yep.
Then there's known enemy spy spotted and fed disinfo until the enemy turned on her. I think that those two are the same thing, but I don't agree with the first one then. The first one we just talked about indicates that she was a leaker. Nobody in the Trump administration knew it. I don't get it. That doesn't make any sense. Let's just do number two. Excuse me. Just forget everything I just said. Rewind.
You wasted everybody's time.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm crying. I get the ugly cry. Okay. Number three. Flipped enemy spy. Willingly feeding disinformation to the enemy. So she was literally, purposefully, as per the administration, delivering disinformation to the media. The media found out and outed her as a source. And then she had to step down, because obviously she can't sit there and still continue her job, but she did it as a sacrificial lamb. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely did.
Okay. So if this turns out to be the case, that they knew, that the administration knew that she was a spy, or knew that she was a leaker, and did it on purpose and used her to leak on purpose, right? If that turned out to be the case, Brian says, WAPO finally figured out that they were being fed disinformation through her, and then they outed her as their source in retaliation, so she needs to go. Brian actually thinks that that's what may have happened in Hope Hicks's case. Is that Hope Hicks? She's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. Hope Hicks was leaking, but they wanted her to, and they figured her out, and so she had to leave because she couldn't obviously be effective in that position anymore.
Right.
The leaks are real. The news is fake. And Donald Trump put out a statement Another totally fake story in the Amazon Washington Post, quote, lobbyist, which states that if my aides broke the law to build the wall, which is going up rapidly, I would give them a pardon. This was made up by the Washington Post only in order to demean and disparage. Fake news. Wouldn't it be funny if Trump realized that they were fake news, right? And he knew that they were fake news and they were going to report bad stuff. But just to be extra douchebaggy, he decided he was going to plant gazillions of fake stories to completely expose them as the nonsense that they are. And this entire time has been
Wouldn't it be funny? Well, he has a history of what was that one story that he left a voicemail on? This was years ago. I forget what the story was where he actually went out and he planted his own stories. He used a pseudonym. He left somebody a voicemail. I think it was back in the 90s. Oh, I'm forgetting all the pieces of this puzzle.
You're wasting everybody's time.
I know, and it was a good one, too. I think it was brought up, what was his name? Trump prank phone call 90s leak story. Let's see what pops back. Trump masqueraded. This is like, wait, let's see here. Trump masqueraded at, God. The ads. Oh, open an incognito window. Just give them a penny. Donald Trump masqueraded as publicist to brag about himself. The voice instantly familiar, the tone confident, even cocky, the cadence distinctly Trumpian. The man on the phone vigorously defending Donald Trump says he's a media spokesman named John Miller.
Oh, yes, John Miller.
And then he says, I'm sort of new here and, quote, I'm somebody that he knows and I think somebody that he trusts and likes. Even, quote, I'm going to do this little part time and then, yeah, go on with my life.
Oh, my God.
The recording obtained by the Washington Post captures what New York reporters and editors who covered Trump's early career experienced in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. Calls from Trump's Manhattan office that resulted in conversations with John Miller or John Barron, public relations men who sound precisely like Trump himself, who indeed are Trump, masquerading as an unusually helpful and boastful advocate for himself, according to journalists and several of Trump's top aides.
Totally forgot about this.
Oh, yeah. No, you have to bring this up, because if there is anybody who likes the idea of having somebody around them who is specifically going to plant stuff, he used to do it for himself.
That's so freaking awesome. I totally forgot.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know, you got to go to Brian's thread and just post that article just underneath this thread.
Okay. Well, here, you know what? He'll probably see comments from you more than he will from me. I'll just send it to you and you can do it.
Yeah, I'll do it. But it's right. So good. Oh my God. I can't. And John Miller was another name, was a name that was important for another reason. John Miller, wasn't that like...
I just sent it to you on Twitter.
Okay.
Donald Trump masking. I mean, you could probably find better stuff on the John Miller stuff, but there was a reporter who received call. I forgot what the actual story was about, that a female reporter had received a voicemail from a John Miller. I think she was talking to Rachel Maddow about it. Or it was, hold on, let me go to YouTube real quick. Let me see. Reporter Trump John Miller. Let's see. Oh, yes. Reporter who, it was CNN, People Magazine reporter who interviewed John Miller. Sue Carswell, the reporter who spoke to Trump press rep, quote unquote, John Miller, in 1991, describes the encounter and why she suspects Trump leaked the tape himself.
Is it a video?
Yeah, it's a video. It's shocking. It's funny. It's actually just hilarious.
Can you play it?
Let me see. It's 6 minutes long, so I don't know. There's a clip in here somewhere that'll be funny. You'll pause for a second.
Okay, so we're back. We took a little break real quick to get this settled. This is months before the election in 2016. Frank found this clip. It says, as the chyron underneath, reporter, Trump leaked own tape. Are we ready?
Yeah.
They should know this. What is wrong with these people?
To what happened. It's 1991. You're at People Magazine. He's got some domestic discord. You call Trump. Trump's office. Yes. And what happens?
I called his office and asked to speak with Trump about the tabloid headlines that he had dumped Marla for Carla Bruni. And I got a call back from a spokesperson who claimed he was John Miller, and who sounded, and I said, you sound just like Trump. It's remarkable that he was able to, you know, hire a publicist to sound just like him. And he said, well, you know, I just come from places. He wasn't very specific. And I had my list of questions, so I just went on with them. But your
antenna were immediately raised.
Well, it was just like, this is uncanny.
Right.
So we went on, we talked, and then I made it go a little longer. And then I got off the phone, and I immediately walked down the halls, and I said, this is Trump. And then we had a call and get three confirmations, and we called Cindy Adams from the New York Post, who said, that's Trump, what's he doing? And then we called another person, and then I called Marla, who just cried when I played the tape for her.
She was then the girlfriend and was hoping
to be
affianced.
Well, she had a so-called engagement ring, she had thought.
There's other anecdotes about voicemails and other things. So it's just when you bring this up, I think about it like he's like Dennis the Menace, but he grew up.
These people forget that he did this, and they just talked about it less than 3 years ago.
Yeah,
I mean, they should have been ready for this nonsense. It's so funny. I can't. Well, this is a great place to end.
Yeah.
God bless our president. Never again in history can this ever be duplicated.
Nope.
We are lucky to be alive right now. Yes. We really are, Frank.
Yeah, I'm having a good time.
I mean, really, like, you know, in 20 years, we're going to look back on this and nobody's going to hate him anymore the way they do now. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, not at all.
And we're going to laugh at these things because, you know, I mean, it's just great. Listen. You guys have been listening to the Dark to Light PF. Here we go. Dark to Light podcast with...
Gorgeous Friday, beautiful, crisp, cool weather, the sweet-smelling breeze, sunny here at the late August afternoon now, Val.
And Beans. You can hear us every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I started thinking about the BDSM comment again. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Only on TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple iTunes, and Radio Influence. RadioInfluence.com. I'll see you Monday.
Later.
Hey gang, Jerry Pete's Huck here, co-host of the brand new podcast called A Place for My Head. Each week, Brandon Thompson and I are going to be talking about the importance of mental health. We're going to be talking everything from stress, anxiety, different mental illnesses, different chronic illnesses, and frankly, the rigors of everyday life and how we all struggle to get through it. We're not medical professionals, but we are looking to start that conversation that needs to be had about the stigma around mental illness and how it affects us every single day. We'll talk to experts, but at the end of the day, A Place for My Head is all about real people with real stories about real life. Subscribe now to A Place for My Head with Brandon Thompson and myself, Jerry Petock. First show drops Monday, September 2nd on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.